This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you ready for rapid sea level rise? The ocean will flow relentlessly inland on almost every coastline in the world. In this special Rising Seas number 3, American oceanographer John Englander, author of High Tide on Main Street, explains the great march inland of rising oceans. Scientist Elko Rowling says a sea level rise 3 meters, 10 feet per century is possible. Texas scientist Pankaj Khanna shows the sea can rise many meters in a single century. It can happen. A new collection broadcast on Radio EcoShock for August in 2019. Coastlines known for centuries are beginning to merge inland. Streets flood even without storms, and the surge from each hurricane seems larger than the one before. According to early reports, Hurricane Matthew set new storm surge records in many parts of the American Southeast. None of that is news to our next guest. John Englander is the American oceanographer who literally wrote the book on rising seas. It's called High Tide on Main Street, now in an updated edition. He's been the CEO for the Cousteau Society and the International Seakeepers. Englander founded the Rising Seas Group to advise governments, industry, and communities. But John Englander also has a degree in economics. He can speak to the developing financial cost and social rearrangements we either make or will be forced to make. John Englander, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Glad to be with you.
When it comes to rising seas, can we say that all of us are witnessing the birth of a new age?
Absolutely. In fact, it's hard to see it because it is so new. For 5,000 years, sea level hasn't changed much because the planet has been in a fairly stable climate regime. But when we look back millions of years and see the ice ages, we realize that climate did change naturally. But now we are broken out of that natural cycle without getting into detail, perhaps. But the fact is we are entering a new era after about 5,000 years of stability. And seas will rise. The ocean temperature is warming. Currents are changing. Temperatures, rainfall, all of that.
In the first edition of your book, you predicted the kind of damage that hit New York and New Jersey with Hurricane Sandy. How did you know?
Well, what I was describing was a scenario for what would happen if we had a superstorm that happened to come up the North Atlantic and head toward the Northwest and would happen to hit in Atlantic City, New York, and just to describe the kind of mega damage. The fact that that happened 1 week after my book was published surprised me as much as anybody else, frankly. I wasn't predicting it would happen then. I was describing scenarios to begin to help people see the future. A number of others have also happened that I described in my book as scenarios. But, you know, if you understand the physics properly and can look at the big picture, we all realize that to some degree we have a pretty good chance of our forecasts or our scenarios becoming true. And Hurricane Sandy was just an extreme example.
It's early days, but did Hurricane Matthew fulfill your expectations of higher storm surge?
Yes. Again, my expectation is to really step back and look at the big picture and say the ice is melting, the seas are rising, we've got more heat in the Earth system, we've trapped it in the ocean mostly, and so the oceans are warmer. So we're going to get new currents, we're going to get more evaporation, which means more moisture in the atmosphere, which means heavier rainfall events, and these are going to manifest as these kind of strange storms or weird weather, as some people prefer to say. And Matthew was an example of that. We're going to get these record-breaking temperatures and record-breaking storms and out of the pattern. And we need to get used to the fact that weather is going to become abnormal. In fact, abnormal will be the new normal. And Matthew was an example of that.
What's the role of the hotter ocean in these storms?
Storms, whether it be a hurricane, it's moving heat. And if you heat the oceans and the ocean currents change, and the air currents, like the jet stream changes, as has been happening more and more, it produces weird weather because our weather pattern, what the temperature will be, what the rainfall patterns will be, all came about because of fairly stable ocean atmospheric currents. And we know that if we put a pot of water on the stove and we turn up the heat, we can see the currents in the pot changing. And the same thing's happening with the ocean. it's hard to predict because the oceans are several kilometers deep. So we're seeing the Gulf Stream move a little bit and slow down a little bit. We're seeing the El Nino currents in the Pacific. All of these things are changing outside of their normal boundaries because we've cranked up the heat on the pot, the giant pot that is the world's ocean. So all of that does connect, and, of course, the evaporation comes as you warm water. You get more evaporation, not boiling, but just evaporation, and that comes down as heavier rain or even snowfall, and we're seeing that.
So could you take a little time and describe for us the slow but determined process of the ocean reclaiming land in the United States, for example, or, if you wish, in other countries?
Sure. Again, we've had a fairly stable shoreline for about 5,000 years, which is pretty much human civilization. And the height of the ocean determines the shoreline at a macro level. And so the amount of ice on land, not the floating ice around the North Pole, which is floating sea ice, but the ice on land, which is from Greenland and Antarctica, is where 97% of it is, and then all the glaciers from Alaska across Canada to the Alps and Scandinavia, that's the ice on land. And the height of the oceans reflects the amount of ice on land. And normally this changes in a roughly 100,000-year cycle, with the oceans going up and down about 120 meters or almost 400 feet. We were ignorant of that because we happened along at the turning point between the up phase and what would have been the down phase as we entered a cooling period. But we've changed that. We've heated the oceans, and we are now melting more ice on land, in the first case Greenland, and then the glaciers all over the world, and the next to follow will be Antarctica. And it's a long-term trend. It's unstoppable now. We can try to slow it, and we should, and we also need to begin adapting to parts that's now inevitable.
So, John, this summer you traveled by ship to Greenland. Tell us about that. What was the purpose of the mission, and how did you get there?
Actually, we traveled to Greenland by airplane. Then once we were there, we went on helicopters and on ships. The purpose of the trip was the commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, Admiral Paul Zukunft, had me do a keynote or a briefing for all of his admirals 8 or 10 months ago. And the more he thought about it and we talked about the phenomenon of rising sea level, he realized that the U.S. Coast Guard had to be prepared for what was going to happen by mid-century. And that, too, he wanted to see firsthand this case of what's happening with the glaciers in Greenland, because icebergs were becoming more prolific as the glaciers melt, counterintuitively. And also that the melting and opening up of the Arctic seaways presents more shipping traffic, which is an issue for the Coast Guards, and potential environmental issues from oil spills and accidents and collisions with icebergs. But also that the opening up of the Arctic is why the world's weather is changing. So Greenland or the far Canadian Arctic are great places to go and look at that. So the commandant of the Coast Guard organized the trip and brought me along as his climate expert and met with his Danish counterparts to try and understand this so that the Coast Guard was always prepared, which is their motto, looking ahead decades into the future.
So do you think Greenland melt will happen fast enough to affect my listeners, the people living now, or are we talking about something for future generations?
Well, let's think that if a generation is 25 years or so, your listeners now, many of them will live past the turn of the next century, or some of them will, not maybe not your listeners, but certainly into the year 2050, 2075. And in that time frame, in the next 40 to 60 years, let's say, which covers two generations, and that would include your listeners, I would presume, that we are going to see sea level rise. In fact, it has just started, but it's just started so small that it's hard to notice. But Greenland will probably produce somewhere between 30 centimeters, or that's a foot, and double that, maybe triple that this century. The problem is Antarctica has 7 times the amount of ice as Greenland, and therefore 7 times the potential sea level rise. And the big potential change is how far the melting of the West Antarctic glaciers proceeds. That's the big question mark. We don't know whether we're going to get 1 meter or 2 meters from Antarctica this century. And we won't know because predicting an ice sheet's collapse, and this is ice that's 3 kilometers thick, 2 miles thick, is kind of like predicting an earthquake or predicting an avalanche. If you're up in the mountains, and we've all probably been there, and if there was enough snow precariously on the top of a mountain, they might tell us there was a risk of an avalanche, but they can't tell us when, just like we can't predict when an earthquake will happen. Well, the problem is that the 3 kilometers of ice on Greenland and bigger quantities on Antarctica, they're showing signs of early melting, and they're showing signs of collapse. And so we don't know whether we're going to get 30 centimeters, 50 centimeters, that's a foot or a foot and a half, or 3 times that in the second half of this century. But here's the reality that I always conclude for every group that I talk to, and whether it be corporate or larger audiences or conferences, we need to do 2 things. We need to slow the warming as quickly as possible, working on greenhouse gases. But even if we were 100% successful, even if we could bring greenhouse gases to zero today, which we can't, but if we could, we'd still get sea level rise. So there's no time to waste to start building higher. We know that sea level's been higher before. It's been lower. We know it's going to be higher decade by decade, century by century. Now is the time to begin planning for higher sea level.
Radio EcoShock.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the famous American oceanographer John Englander. We're talking about the arrival of a rising ocean on land. Well, your TEDx talk in Boca Raton, Florida was well placed. John, isn't Florida on the front lines of this onslaught of rising seas in America?
Yes, it is. And I happen to live here, which is why I did the local TED talk when it was here. But the fact is, Alex, you know, we really need to get out of our minds that this is just a Florida problem. And you're based in Canada. I was in Vancouver, not too far from you, last week. I was in Toronto a few weeks before that. I was in Prince Edward Island before that, in Nova Scotia. But every country in the world, from Bangladesh to London, Netherlands, to Singapore, Shanghai, Mumbai, every place in the world that's on the coast, and it's worse in places where the elevation, the topography is low, and, you know, doesn't climb too quickly. So Florida there is, of course, a good example, but Vietnam and Bangladesh are even worse, and more tens of millions of people in those places. We've got to realize that as sea level rises, it's every coastal city in the world, and it's not just cities on the coast, it's those cities on tidal rivers. So that would be up the Fraser River in British Columbia, that would be the St. Lawrence Seaway, that would be the Thames River in London. Cities from Sacramento, California to Hartford, Connecticut are 80 miles, 120 kilometers inland in the United States. They're vulnerable to sea level rise. We've got to really open our minds and realize that the shoreline is determined by sea level. And they've both been stable for about 5,000 years, all of human civilization. That era is gone. We should do all the good environmental things. We should certainly try and reduce greenhouse gases to slow the warming. But the third thing we've got to do is begin to adapt to higher sea level, which is now unstoppable, and it's not limited to Florida.
Do you think Miami will eventually go underwater?
Eventually, and so will the Florida Keys and parts of the Bahamas, and so will the islands in the Pacific and Indian Ocean that people fear about, the Maldives and Kiribati, and so will parts of British Columbia. And so, and again, will Miami? Yes, and it's iconic, and people think about it, and it probably has a more economic value at risk than any other city. But even if it happens over the next 100 years or so, and the flooding just gets more and more frequent in the meantime, again, we would do your listeners a disservice if we said it's a Miami problem. Because the fact is, it's a New Orleans problem. It's a Annapolis, Maryland. It's a San Francisco Bay. It's the truth is, every coastal country in the world.
You talked about the financial angle of this. You have studied economics. Right now, currently, coastal real estate is the most expensive, but according to the science, many of these homes and businesses will become first uninsurable, then worthless, and then maybe gone. Could this trigger a financial implosion worse than the 2008 housing crisis?
Yes, but the difference will be that a financial crisis can happen almost instantly as soon as there's a realization of a problem. The growing awareness that sea level is rising will be a slower phenomenon. And the decline in property values will be slower, both because the realization and acceptance or the denial disappearing will happen over years or decades. But on top of that, sea level can't suddenly rise. I mean, I hate to say it, the good news about sea level rise is we have time to prepare. The good news is it can't happen quickly like a tsunami or even a sudden storm like Matthew or Sandy, but it's unstoppable. And the sooner we wake up to that and realize we have to begin slowly adapting, the better. And I think real estate values will do the inverse. I think they will slowly begin to decline, realizing that coastal real estate has a finite life as the sea rises and the shoreline tries to move inland.
And what about the economic cost of having to replace ports or big infrastructure like Boston's Central Artery Tunnel or the Big Dig or New York's subways? Can any country really afford this?
Well, the answer is none of them can and all of them will. And that sounds counterintuitive, because the truth is there's not enough money in the world to compensate people for the land that will go underwater. No government, not the United States, not Saudi Arabia, not China, could afford to make everybody whole with the new realization, which most people don't even have yet, but hopefully your listeners are ahead of the curve here, with the realization that sea level is permanently going to rise many meters. So nobody can afford that. Yet the reality is this isn't like an option, like should we have a preschool education or some kind of subsidized health care. If the ocean wants to be 1 meter or 2 meters or 3 meters higher, it doesn't matter what we want, and we will find the money to either move out of the way or build things higher or put in pumps or adapt to it. This is not optional.
As you know, our world is heavily influenced by big corporations who straddle borders all over the globe. John Englander, are big companies looking into the problem of changing oceans and have any contacted you?
I would say it's the early stage. Several have. I can't name them. Part of my being retained to help people think this through strategically is they want to be able to do it without it being public. So I have to sign non-disclosure agreements, as you'd imagine, and also with national security interests that are trying to look to the world of the future. But it's still the early stage. I would have to say that I've been doing this now for 6 years, I guess. I started writing my book 8 years ago. My book came out 4 years ago, 2012, and year by year, the awareness and interest is growing, but it's still early stage. For most businesses, to think beyond 5 years is kind of over the horizon. But if it's framed well, if we explain to people that this is inevitable and that now is the time to plant the seeds for future businesses, for future communities, for estate planning, for strategic planning of how the world will change when the ocean is, again, 1, 2, or 3 meters taller, moving the shoreline in many kilometers in some cases. It's a disruptive idea. There are a few leaders, but year by year, the interest is expanding quickly.
Well, I'm hoping eventually, and it may be a tipping point, that comes out of the shadows and everyone says quite openly, yes, we're planning for this because it's obvious. Now, you've proposed intelligent adaptation. Can you give us an example?
Sure. In my book, High Tide on Main Street, as you cited, I come up with what I call the 5 points of intelligent adaptation. One is to act with a long-term perspective. If we step back and see where something is headed, we can actually plan and adapt better than looking at it day by day or year by year. So we have to realize that for sea level, that it's going to just get higher, you know, every tens of centimeters or every foot for Americans, but it's going to become meter by meter higher, which is 3 feet by 3 feet, if you will, as a round figure. And if we're going to invest in new structures and bridges and tunnels and higher buildings and seawalls, the earlier we can plan for where things are headed, the better return on investment. So that's one. The second is, as far as the projections for sea level rise, we need to recognize there's a range of projections that for the reasons I alluded to earlier, there's no way to accurately say how far the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets will collapse, which is what will ultimately cause sea level to rise by 60-some meters over the next several centuries or millennia. We don't know. Let's begin to act knowing there's a range. So whether the range of projection by mid-century is a half meter or a meter, by the end of the century is 1 meter to 3 meters, let's start adapting now, just like we do for a range of other projections for interest rates or the price of gold or the price of real estate or the price of gasoline. Three is we need to consider geology as well as topography, I like to say. So there's the slope of the land. How quickly does it rise up will determine how far inland rising sea level will push the shoreline. But also there's geology. Miami is porous limestone, as are most of the coral-based tropical islands like the Maldives and the Bahamas and Kiribati. And those porous limestone locations you can't protect with a seawall, because you could build a seawall right around the island, but it would, or Miami, and it would just come up inside like a sponge. The fourth is we need to recognize that ultimately the governments can't bail us out of this. They can facilitate, they can help transition, they can do some new policies, but to think that the government's going to buy everybody out of all of the coastal land that they own is naive. It may work for year by year, maybe a decade or two, but there's no government that has the resources to compensate their people for believing the shoreline wouldn't move in the long term. And five is to begin, as you suggested earlier, that properties will be value. And you wisely pointed out that we tend to put a premium price on coastal real estate. And to realize that the coastline is going to move inland over the next century means that for those that want to look ahead and adapt intelligently, that they can choose the time to sell or to move or to raise their house, but that would be an important part of intelligent adaptation, to realize that properties will devalue and we will need to either build higher, relocate, or adapt.
Some politicians, especially in Florida but elsewhere, have doubled down on denial of climate change. We had the same thing happen in Australia and for 10 years here in Canada. And the whole issue of climate change has had less coverage in the current presidential election than the sex lives of the candidates. What happens if humans are not intelligent enough to act to save themselves from mega change in the oceans?
Well, you know, that's a great question, almost a philosophical one, and it's something I do grapple with. Are we smart enough? And where I come off on the two parts of this, the two facets, again, is we're seeing more flooding, whether it be a storm surge like during a Matthew or a Sandy or a Katrina event, whether we're seeing heavier rainfall event, we're starting to see more and more flooding, and people are getting worried about that. And you can't argue with flooding, and it's the question of whether you see the pattern. Whether we can be smart enough to globally deal with burgeoning population and need for energy and rapidly enough change our energy policies, that's, I guess, the human behavior and political question, economics. There's some optimistic signs that over a course of years, British Columbia, where you happen to live, is probably the best example in the world, frankly, where the tax that was put on carbon in 2008 and escalated pretty quickly is now a model for many other places. It reduces other taxes. It wasn't an additional tax. It was a replacement tax to put the price on carbon, but reduce other forms of taxation. And now Canada's recently announced, in fact, in the last few days, that it's going to try and model that policy and expand it nationwide. So I think we'll do those things. It'll take us a few years or decades. But, you know, the good thing about sea level rise, I say, it's not a choice. It's not a choice of whether to adapt. And, of course, we can fantasize about building cities underwater and so on. But that's we're not going to house 7 billion or 10 billion people underwater. The truth is, as the ocean rises for the first time in all of human civilization, we will adapt. The question is whether we do it by catastrophe and crisis or by planning.
After your trip to Greenland and your handy four-part series on changes there, what will you be working on next?
Well, I'm first of all, I'm working to start a sea level institute, the International Sea Level Institute. SeaLevelInstitute.org is a beginner website, and there's a little video there. We're looking to find the right base location and then to establish some nodes in different places in the world to help professionals like architects, engineers, bankers, town planners understand this and incorporate it into what they're doing. So that's a real passion of mine. I'm writing another book, which I hope to have out in 2017. There's a group who wants to work on a documentary about my work and even a feature film. And I'm giving more and more lectures. Last week I was in Vancouver talking to the International Association of Aquariums. A few weeks before that, I was talking to the architects of Florida. So it's bringing different interested groups into understanding, and I love doing that. And for those that are interested, it's on my website. But speaking to groups, bringing groups of professionals and different cohorts, but even environmentalists like your audience, is really an important way to get the word out.
Our guest, John Englander, advises governments and private stakeholders on the science and financial impacts of rising seas. John is a well-known oceanographer with a wealth of experience, and he's put out a comprehensive guide for the public. Still a really good book, High Tide on Main Street. You can find a lot more at John's website at johnenglander.net, and I'll put helpful links in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. John, thank you so much for being our guest on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thank you. I love the focus of your program and the fact that you're on almost 100 stations, and I appreciate the opportunity and hope that your listeners will pursue and consider this information in the weeks and years ahead.
Good. Well, I hope to get back to you as this whole story progresses, and as we know it will. I'm Alex Smith, reporting. I had that first encounter with John Englander in 2016.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In a warming world, we picture sea level rise creeping up very slowly, measured in inches or millimeters. Maybe not. According to new science, at the end of the last five ice ages, the seas rose several meters per century, more than 10 feet. Elko Rowling is a professor of ocean and climate change at the University of Southampton in Australia. He's the co-author of the paper, Sea Level Variability Over Five Glacial Cycles, that was just published in the journal Nature Communications. Dr. Rowling, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. How are you?
Good, good. Why did you take on this study?
It's the sort of work that we have been engaged in for almost two decades now. So one of the things what it drives it is curiosity, is about what has been happening in our natural past before man started to interfere with climate, and you know, to get a context of what has been changing in a natural sense.
Okay, now I understand how we could measure sea level rise in past ages, but how can we know how fast it happened, right down to a century time period, which is rather short in geological time?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So what we need for that is we need continuous records of sea level change in a high time resolution, and we developed that with a new methodology of using past salinity changes in the Red Sea. And what we recently then added to that is a very strong time control to that. So we have a highly resolved record with a very good time control. And that's when we can start to look at rates of change.
How did the Asian monsoons fit into that research?
The Asian monsoons have been affecting the regional climate, and that regional climate is in that sector is recorded in cave sediments. And these cave deposits and stalagmites, they can be really accurately dated with the uranium series, a radioactive decay. And that really accurate dating of these climate time series we could transfer to the Red Sea sea level record that we derived from the Red Sea seafloor sediments. And in that way, we could derive a very good chronology or time scale for the sea level changes.
Can you talk us through one case that you studied? What was Earth like then and what happened?
Well, one of the most studied cases for sea level change at the last ice age is around about 14,600 years ago. Sea level made a jump, and that jump has been dated with fossil corals in other methods to about 4.5 meters per century. But what we can now do with this new method is we can look at other ends of ice ages, the ends of five ice ages. So first thing, we corroborate that estimate from the corals for the last deglaciation, but we can now also find it for four other deglaciations. And we find basically numbers that are very similar, especially for an event that was of the order of about 240,000 years ago and 330,000 years ago. Those two events were very similar, of the order of 4 to 5 meters per century.
4 to 5 meters, that's over 16 feet for our American listeners. Now, we should stress that sea level rise comes from land-based ice and not the more well-known melting of the sea ice cover on the ocean at the North Pole. Where is land ice melting now?
Well, land ice today is melting in the Greenland ice sheet, and especially the West Antarctic ice sheet and the Antarctic Peninsula. At the moment, the East Antarctic ice sheet is only contributing very little mass in terms of its loss, but that there is a potential there for that to speed up quite a bit as well. But we have to bear in mind that these very high rates, they are at the ends of ice ages. So we're basically talking about periods when there was almost three times as much ice on the planet as there is now, because there was a really large ice sheet, larger than the modern Antarctic ice sheet on North America. And there was an equally very large ice sheet on Europe of the size of, you know, several times the Greenland ice sheet. So there was a lot more ice, and as a result, you would expect, and that's what we now find, a lot more melt contribution. And that is what we found in our research, is that we have about 120 sea level rise events where they are smaller, but they are happening also at times when there was less ice on the planet. These rates are actually for the future more important. They are smaller rates. Yeah, so I guess maybe if we want to look at the future, we should look at those smaller rates that happen in between these large deglaciations.
Right. So because we're starting out with less ice than, you know, the whole of North America is not covered with ice as much of it was, I guess we are not looking at that worst case scenario of a 5 meter per century sea level rise. Am I right on that?
Exactly. So what we now have is, you know, in time to when we had two times the amount of ice of today or less, the rates that we find were below 2 meters per century. And when we are constraining it further down to times when there was about the same amount of ice as today on the planet, the rates are between 1 and 1.5 at most meters per century. So we're looking at smaller but still quite large rates.
Yes, it would have a huge effect on the world's ports and major cities if sea level even went up 1 meter when you add the storm surge and things like that.
Exactly.
Now, once this process of ice melt starts, does it look to be irreversible?
It's what we're beginning to find is when we start seeing signals of ice reduction. So every time we see sea level starts to go up in our record, then in about 68% of the rises, and we're talking about 120 cases that we studied, so statistically a good number, in 68% of those cases, it's about 400 years of rise until we hit the maximum rate. So and in about 85% of the cases, it's 600 years. So what we're beginning to see is that once the ice begins to reduce, once you start seeing that reduction really going, until you get the peak rates of reduction is hundreds of years. So that would suggest that situation could well be irreversible, because it takes so long for these large ice sheets to start responding. And as a result, once they are responding, it's like a freight train. It takes long to start moving, and then it also takes long to stop when you hit the brakes full.
I'm really stunned by what you're saying. Are you saying that we're imposing a constantly rising sea and ever-changing coastline on all the humans and animals and plants to come for hundreds of years?
Well, I'm not saying we are imposing, but what I am saying is that, to me, the signal is very much like this, is that, you know, where warming of the planet is potentially irreversible, if we reverse the CO2 emissions, we may have already committed ourselves to several hundreds of years of sea level rise simply by what has started to work over the last 100 to 150 years.
Professor Elko Rowling, it's my understanding that the past transitions from an icy world to a warmer one developed over very long periods, perhaps stimulated by relatively slight changes in the Earth's orbit. Can we really compare those slower changes to what might happen as we change the whole atmosphere with our greenhouse gases?
Yeah, that's the big, that's the elephant in the room, really. The big question is whether the natural changes were really slow. I mean, the orbital changes, the Earth-Sun system, those orbital changes are very slow, but those are really only the trigger. And what we see happening is that as soon as we trigger a deglaciation with the orbital changes, most of the deglaciation is actually carried out by a feedback between temperature and CO2 and other greenhouse gases like methane. Now, currently, we are raising the CO2 concentration, the greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere by our anthropogenic actions, maybe 100 or more times faster than those natural feedback processes. The only thing you have to worry with sea level is whether the ice sheets could actually follow that quickly. Maybe they are too slow. They are what we would call rate limited. If they are rate limited, then we could force the atmosphere as fast as we like, but we might not be able to get the ice to respond faster than it is possible. Now, that's a big discussion. We don't know if there is a rate limitation or not. There's quite a lot of discussion about that. So what we are coming up with numbers are for natural responses to the current CO2 forcing, and it could actually be worse if our fast forcing has a worse effect. But that's really for us to keep on monitoring. If we look at the way that the sea level rise currently is happening, it's quite slow, you would say, with about 3 millimeters per year, but it projects to quite a high number, to about a meter by 2100, because it is the early phase of the acceleration of the ice sheets that we are looking at, together with thermal expansion and some other effects.
Your paper talks about meltwater pulse. What is that?
A meltwater pulse is really when we are in a deglaciation, so basically we are in a fast phase of ice reduction. Sometimes there are pulses in those where we see a peak reduction of the ice sheets, and that is the current thought is that we are looking at some sort of dynamic process that actually allows the ice streams to accelerate to a maximum rate towards the ocean where they calve off. And so that would then give you your maximum rate of rise in a deglaciation period. So the deglaciation period overall could be 10,000 years long, but in the last deglaciation, for example, you had a 400-year period with about 4.5 meters per century rise inside that long period. So it's really a short maximum event within a longer deglaciation. And what we are finding is that all of these have rates of the order of meters per century.
Now, I'd like you to relate what this paper says and what your current research is compared to the current round of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Does your paper go with the estimates that have been published so far? Will they have to be revised?
What we're basically seeing is that past deglaciation events are actually quite coherent with the most recent one, which was already quite well known from fossil corals research. So in a sense, our values are nothing new to the IPCC, because they had already one value like that they are taking into account. The only thing is, what they didn't have is an estimate of these deglaciation rates that had to do with times of ice sheets smaller than present. So basically, the IPCC has been very much looking at what is the maximum amount we could get off the ice sheets, such as the last interglacial period, about 125,000 years, and sea level went somewhere between 6 and 9 meters above the present. That was more like the magnitude of rise. What we are now beginning to see is that we could put a likely number on the naturally possible rate of rise for such an event of the order of 1 to 1.5 meters per century.
Tell us about the number of scientists and the amount of time it takes to assemble this record of sea level changes for the past 500,000 years.
One would have to measure that in a period of, we started this sort of work around about 2000, and so we're talking about 14 years, and there would have been, on average, I would say, 3 persons working on it every year. So we're talking about something like 14 times 3 man years of work, 42 man years of work. You know, it's not always full time just on this. There are other offshoots as well, but that's the sort of effort that goes into it. Yeah.
Now, is it possible, Professor Rowling, to go back even further looking for evidence of a large, rapid sea level change that could teach us what we could expect with human-induced climate change? Can we go back millions of years?
Well, we've recently started to divert our attentions from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, where the signal-to-noise ratio is worse, so we don't get very accurate records like we do in the Red Sea, but we can go back to 5.3 million years ago. But you have to bear in mind that what we are losing there is the finesse to the method where we can actually start to get really good rates of rise. I mean, we could get, you know, average rates of rise over a couple of thousand years or so, but we don't really get that time control or the actual signal-to-noise ratio to really start talking about these meters per century values. I think that's a very long time away that we can do that on older records than 500,000.
As we finish up, is there more exciting science coming up that can help us further understand this process of a climate shift?
Yeah, what we're beginning to do now is what we found in the Red Sea early on in about 2007, 2008, is that in the last interglacial, there potentially have been a couple of fluctuations of the sea level rise above 0 meters, so above the present. So when the sea level of the last interglacial went up to between 6 and 9 meters above the present, it seems to have been doing that in stops and starts and actually reversed for a time as well and then went up again. And that's what we're currently beginning to look at with some new techniques to see if we can refine that and firm that up, and especially if we can actually find corroborating evidence from other areas for that fluctuation. If we can, then we can start to look at rates of rise in detail above the present rate. So that would be directly relevant to deglaciating from the current condition to sea level several meters higher. And what we're beginning to see is that the rates that were involved with that were, again, of the order of 1 to 1.5 meters per century. Now, if that bears out, then that really starts to support our case that these rates may well be relevant to the future as well.
We've been talking about the latest sea level science with Dr. Elko Rowling. He's a professor of ocean and climate change at the University of Southampton and Australian National University. His latest paper, Sea Level Variability Over 5 Glacial Cycles, was published September 25th, 2014, in the journal Nature Communications. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, that was my pleasure. I mean, it's always good to try and sort of convey this information to the wider audience rather than just in the technical journals. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. That conversation with Australian scientist Elko Rowling was in 2014.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Now we will hear the news that governments, the public, and most scientists, really, have not yet digested. Sea level does not creep up regularly, as shown on all our charts. During warming, it can rise rapidly in steps that could easily displace hundreds of millions of people in a few decades and rearrange the world as we know it. Over the past few centuries, humans have recorded a predictable and relatively gradual rise of the oceans. But a new study from scientists at Rice University warned that isn't how climate change worked in the past. Mapping out extinct coral reefs off the coast of Texas revealed a warning: seas can and do rise in sudden steps. I remember Dr. James Hansen told us we could see up to 3 meters of sea level rise by the end of this century. And I don't have to tell you what that means for global cities built on coastlines or the human project in general. But how do we know this can happen or that it has happened? Pankaj Khanna is the lead author of a paper published in Nature Communications on October 19, 2017. The title is Coralgal Reef Morphology Records Punctuated Sea Level Rise During the Last Deglaciation. Pankaj got his master's at the University of New Delhi before traveling to Rice University in Texas for his PhD. He has worked extensively there with Professor Andre W. Droxler. From Houston, Texas, Pankaj Khanna, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for joining us. So, as a beginning, how can coral drown?
Sure. The corals, the way they work is they need specific parameters to grow. And they need specific lat and longe, which is like they usually grow between 30 degrees north and south. And they need certain salinity conditions, water temperature conditions. And then the most important one is the sea level, the closeness to the sea level. So they like to grow with the sea level. Now, if something happens due to which there is a sudden rapid rise in sea level, such that the rate of rise is faster than the growth rate of the coral reefs, then they can drown.
By drowning, really, doesn't it mean that they're getting below the level of light that they need in order to keep going?
Well, yes. But if you see, the photic zone is 100 meters, or it varies around the ocean. And these reefs, where they want to grow is around like 5 meters or 5 to 10 meters of water depth. So they want to grow in like very, very shallow water depth. And the sunlight can reach much, much lower than that, but the conditions aren't good enough for them to grow if they are like below certain water depth.
Last June, we had coral expert Charlie Varon on Radio EcoShock, and he talked about past extinction events for coral over the half billion years of their time on Earth. But when discussing climate change impacts, Dr. Varon emphasized ocean acidification and ocean temperatures too high for the codependent organisms. Why does your paper point to rising seas as a driver of coral extinction during warming events?
Sure. So this paper is talking about the last deglaciation. And by last deglaciation, I mean last 20,000 years, during which the sea level has risen up to 120 meters. So in general, if you see, there are cyclicity in the way the glaciers melt and the sea level increases. And it is 120 meters in every around 100,000 years, since like past several thousand years. So what has happened is, within the last 20,000 years, the sea level has risen, so it is a warming world. So now, how did the sea level rise in the warming world is exactly what is being pointed out in this study. And why we are saying it's more ocean rises, because there are like some spectacular morphologies, which are called as terraces, and have been observed on all of these reefs. So there are around 10 reefs, around 1 to 2 square kilometers in their size, and around 120 kilometers apart on South Texas shelf. And they've recorded 6 events, 6 terraces, which can be mapped on each of these reefs. And the way we define a terrace is a flat area bounded by steep slopes. So now we have all of these terraces on all of these reefs. The question was how you can form these terraces. And the only way to form terraces is, in our specific study, is by sudden or rapid sea level rise events. And that's why we are saying it's because of the rapid sea level rise events that these reef morphologies were modified. And at a certain point, all of these reefs just died together. And it was around 12,000 years before present.
Well, now to a hard part. It's my understanding we don't have sea level records for periods shorter than about 1,000 years. And without that certain dating, how can your team discover sea level changes that might have happened within 100 years, such a long time ago?
Yes, You're absolutely right. But there are records of up to a few centuries which show dramatic rise in sea level called as meltwater pulses. So the ones which are most famous are meltwater pulse 1A and meltwater pulse 1B. And within a few centuries, like 200 to 300 years, the sea level rose up to 15 to 20 meters during that time period, with the sea level rise rate as fast as 40 millimeters per year. And if you see the sea level rise rate today, it's only 3 millimeters per year. So what we knew was that sea level could rise up to 40 millimeters per year during the last deglaciation, and it has been dated. In our case, we do not have any of the dated material. So what we did, we came up with a model, age model, which we derived from the current terrace depths, as well as the glacial isostatic adjustment. This is a correction which is required to be made due to melting of the glaciers. And the third thing is subsidence. So how much the land has subsided since the initiation of these reefs on South Texas shelf. So using all of these parameters and putting it all together, we came up with the age model of the start of the reef and the end of the reef, and also for all of these terraces. Now, the interesting thing to see is, if you see the climate record on the Greenland ice core, there are about 5 to 6 warming events which match really well to our terraces. And that kind of, you know, gives you already an idea that these kind of events were existing. Right now, we do not have the exact age or amplitude of all these terraces, but we have very clear idea that if you go now with a ship and drill these reefs and date them, you will find the exact amplitude and the timing of these terraces and which would come from a decade to a century.
If I read the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, it predicts a gradual but relentless rise in sea levels from 1 to 3 meters perhaps in this century, depending on what we do about carbon pollution. What are you describing? I mean, if we were to see such an event happen, say in 2050 or something, what could happen?
Well, we are not prepared for that. And what would happen is, like, there will be a dramatic rise in sea level. And like, no model has taken into account these kind of events that our paper is showcasing. So the idea now is that all the future predictions need to incorporate part of this study, and this kind of study that we have conducted, it's first of its kind. It's needed to be replicated in other parts of the world, and we need to prepare for that, because if you imagine, like, within like a decade or two, if the sea level rises up to a meter, that will be devastating, because we are only preparing until like 2100, like the start of the 22nd century, that is like a sea level rise from 2 to 3 meters. But if it happens way earlier, then that would be devastating for the coastal areas all around the world.
Right. We'd have to basically evacuate some coastal cities which have hundreds of millions of people living in them, and we don't know what would happen to the world economy. So it's a pretty important question that you're working on.
Yes, it surely is.
Are you aware of any proof or reasons why we should believe that just because this has happened in the past when you studied, that it could happen again?
Well, yes. First of all, if you look at the reports, like for future predictions, the sea level is supposed to rise, yes? And if we go, like the geologists, the way geology works is, in general, like we say, present is the key to the past. But in this case, you know, we have understanding of the present, how fast the sea levels are rising. We now are having more understanding of the past, how sea will rose in the past. So we have to use the modern understanding and the past understanding to predict the future.
Well, I was asking about, do we have any real proof or indicators that what happened in the past could happen again in the future?
The proof is that we had a warming world during the last deglaciation, which is 20,000 years. So the Earth has been warming, and right now we're also warming the Earth at the same magnitude, which would cause the sea level to rise for sure. And to understand how the sea level would rise is very important. But if you look at the past geological record, we know that around 120,000 years before present right now, the sea level were at least 3 to 5 meters higher than the present sea level that we have. So we have the understanding of how much the cyclicity of the sea level varies. We know how much, like, how the sea level has risen in the past. We have to utilize all of this understanding for future predictions.
Now, according to the paper, sea levels rose pretty rapidly, and then they paused for a while, and then they took another big step. Do we know why?
Yes, this is most likely due to ice stream or ice sheet collapses. So if you see Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet, what you see there are like big icebergs falling off, and like ice sheets are collapsing. And you can imagine if big chunk of the ice sheet collapses suddenly, then the sea level would rise very, very sharply. During that time period, the sea level would be fast. And during the other time period, when the sea level rises, the ice sheets are melting only gradually without like major ice sheet collapses. That's the time period when the sea level is only rising very, very slowly or gradually.
Well, we have a huge risk here to massive deltas where agriculture is important in many countries, to low-lying countries like Bangladesh and the Netherlands. So I'm wondering, where does this science of sea level rise need to go next?
The next would be to prepare for the possible inundation due to sea level rise. And that would be to understand how fast an area like Bangladesh or Netherlands are subsiding in comparison to the sea level rise to get better estimates. And I would say that they need to start preparing now for the future, because we do not have the understanding yet of how soon that devastating future can come. So we need to start preparing now.
We've been discussing new science on what at least 5 levels of extinct coral reefs can tell us about the way sea level happens during climate change. Our guest is the lead author of that study, Pankaj Khanna, from Rice University in Houston, Texas. The paper is Coralgal Reef Morphology Records Punctuated Sea Level Rise During the Last Deglaciation, as published in Nature Communications. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Pankaj, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me here. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That interview with Pankaj Khanna was first broadcast in 2017. You just heard our third special broadcast on rapid sea level rise. Find others in this series at my website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.